From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. If yesterday was Super Tuesday, perhaps today is Winnowing Wednesday. The field of Democrats is winnowing. Michael Bloomberg dropped out after disappointing results. He endorsed Joe Biden, who is now headed for a two-man race for the nomination against Bernie Sanders. Biden won 9, maybe 10 of the 14 states yesterday. Sanders won 4. NPR political reporter Juana Summers is covering demographics and culture in this campaign. She joins us from Washington. Hi, Juana.
Hey there.
So Biden swept across the South last night, won even in places he didn't campaign much, like Virginia. What do you make of what happened?
Yeah, so this is the kind of victory that the Biden campaign could only be dreaming of after having that strong victory in South Carolina. He was propelled across the South by Black voters in a number of states. He picked up large majorities of those, but he also picked up some unexpected victories, including in places like Minnesota, where Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar recently endorsed him. But that was a state that Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders had been favored to win. Biden hadn't even seriously contested it. There's no question that they feel like this was a great night for them. They are even more elated now that Mike Bloomberg, the billionaire media tycoon, has ended his campaign and is signaling that he will back Joe Biden, both symbolically as well as financially, which is a huge brush for this candidate who had not even run ads in some of the states heavily in which he won.
Do we have a sense of how the Sanders campaign feels today?
Yeah, we do. And we'll hear more from Bernie Sanders later today. But what I'm hearing from folks close to his campaign is the fact that they're pointing to their victory in California, where Bernie Sanders was lifted by a number of Latino voters. That was the big delegate prize on this map. We don't yet know how those delegates quite will shake out. California always takes a while to let us know its results, but they feel good about that. They are looking ahead to other states with large Latino electorates. They also feel really good about their stance with young voters, the youngest segments of the electorate, yet again, across all racial and ethnic groups, performing quite well for Bernie Sanders.
Although we heard from Howard Dean, the former chair of the DNC, that he was surprised that young voters didn't turn out in the numbers that he was expecting. We'll see as we find out more. You've been reviewing the exit polls. What do they tell us about support for Biden and Sanders and how that might shape the race as it moves into new states?
Yeah, so this question of turnout and the question of the generational differences is one that I've spent a lot of time looking at. And what I find is particularly interesting when you look at young voters, and I'm going to take that a little bit more liberally to say those under the age of 40 across all racial and ethnic groups, that's a foothold that's really strong for Bernie Sanders. Whereas voters over the age of 65 poll particularly well for Joe Biden across all racial and ethnic groups. So you kind of have this fight for the people in the middle, those folks who are between their 40s and their 60s, and that's where there's really a contest between the two. We know that next week the race heads to places like Michigan that Bernie Sanders carried 4 years ago against Hillary Clinton, and that is a huge general election battleground, and I think it's one place we can look to get a sense of where the momentum is in this race and whether or not this is going to be a long slog in what has effectively become a two-man race now.
Well, remember, Juana, 40 is the new 30, 50 is the new 40, et cetera, et cetera. Now, next week is Big Tuesday, we're calling it, when Michigan, Idaho, Missouri, Mississippi, North Dakota, and Washington State will have their say. Do we know much about the dynamics in those states, how that might play out?
Sure. So we've talked about Michigan as this huge general election battleground that's loomed large for this Democratic Party electorate that's obsessed with electability and beating President Trump. But I want to talk about another state. My home state of Missouri votes next week as well. Roughly one-fifth of the Democratic electorate is expected to be full of African-American voters. So that will be a big test for these candidates, particularly for Bernie Sanders, who, when it comes to Black voters, has lagged behind Joe Biden, who has been resurgent with them.
That is NPR political reporter Juana Summers. Thanks, Juana.
Thank you.
Well, in Texas, Joe Biden won narrowly, but there were long lines reported at a number of polling stations. Jen Rice was at one of those lines at Texas Southern University. That's an historically Black college. She's a reporter with Houston Public Media. Jen, what did you see last night? How long were people waiting?
Yeah, so I got to Texas Southern University around 11 p.m. And at that point, there were, I'd say, 100 people in line waiting to vote. And I was there until 1 o'clock in the morning when the very last people voted.
And the polls closed at 7.
That's correct. Yeah, the polls closed at 7. So people were waiting, 6 hours after the polls had closed.
And what are the reasons? What was behind those lines?
Yeah. So I've reached out to the Harris County Clerk for comments. They haven't actually issued an official statement yet, but Harris County has been going through a big transition over the past year, away from the neighborhood precincts toward the larger voting centers, similar to what they're doing in LA. And so from what I've heard, you know, this is part of that rollout, that there maybe just weren't enough machines there at TSU.
But obviously some people were willing to wait. What did voters tell you about how they felt about those lines?
People were pretty emotional about the delay. Texas Southern University is an HBCU, and, you know, the majority of voters there are African American, and many of them, you know, connected the experience they were having last night to voter suppression that, you know, has been experienced for generations.
That is Jen Rice, a reporter with Houston Public Media. Jen, thank you.
Thank you.
Let's check in now to Washington State, where the majority of the 9 novel coronavirus deaths in the United States have been linked to one place, a long-term care facility near Seattle. Nursing homes and similar care facilities are now taking on new protocols to safeguard against the virus. Joining us now is Mary Huedes. She's an investigative reporter at the Seattle Times. And thanks for joining us, Mary.
Thank you for having me.
So the facility in question is the Life Care Center in Kirkland. It's been referred to as a nursing home. What types of people are living there?
I think largely an elderly population based on the reporting and interviews we've had, although certainly some of the cases we've heard about have been people who are maybe in their 50s. Maybe they're there for a broken hip or getting physical therapy, a range of issues.
What more can you tell us about the Life Care Center's record on containing disease spread?
So they were cited about a year ago. So the citation basically stated there was concern about like staff's washing of hands and properly disposing of sanitary gloves. And those, by and large, maybe don't always have like a high impact on residents. But in that case, last April, through like a series of unannounced visitors, investigators found, you know, there might have been issues with staffers putting away dirty dishes with a certain pair of gloves, and then also in the same kind of moment or so, like putting away clean dishes. At that same month, there was a flu outbreak in the facility. From everything we know, Life Care has taken steps to correct that, but it's not a rare like citation among nursing homes. And so I think that kind of also adds to just the laundry list of concerns that maybe experts or family members might have with nursing homes and this virus.
Yeah. You and your colleagues have spoken with people who have loved ones there at the Life Care Center. What are they telling you about their experiences?
There's largely, I would say, as like a collective kind of take on it, is that there is, you know, feeling like they really just want a lot more communication from Life Care Center or from authorities. You know, I think there's instances where some are able to reach their loved ones. One woman was able actually to enter Sunday night, she said. But in other cases, maybe like people have moved rooms or because, you know, folks are not able to like reach their phone. There just has been minimal communication in a lot of instances.
It sounds very chaotic and developing. But, you know, your newsroom also spoke with the son of an elderly patient who died. He had visited her recently. He is now in quarantine. This sounds like such a tragic story. He had lost his mom and now he's in quarantine. What else did he tell you?
His story was that they had plans to move her separate from the virus on Wednesday. And so she was moved to another much, much smaller, you know, care facility, described as an adult family home. So he knew that she wasn't feeling well, but thought maybe it was like a common cold, and then she ended up passing away the evening that she was moved. So in that case, I think the family learned around Saturday after she had passed away that she may have had it, and then that was confirmed Monday evening.
Yeah. I mean, what we're learning about this virus and the fact that it can be very deadly for people with pre-existing conditions and those over a certain age, it would seem that these types of facilities are particularly vulnerable. Have any of them talked to you or really spoken about some of the challenges there and really keeping this virus at bay?
Well, I think They have spoken about the measures they're taking and the fact that not only like an elderly, are they serving an elderly population, many of who are like recovering from recent, you know, health issues, but also that it's group living. So there's less so with the facilities, but among family members, like concerns that maybe in the days leading up to the revelation that there was a virus spreading, that people were gathered together for parties, mm-hmm. and for you know, nightly dinners. So that's another kind of point of like vulnerability.
That's Mary Hudeds. She's an investigative reporter at the Seattle Times. Mary, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Life Care Center did not agree to interview requests made by the Seattle Times, but in a statement, it said it is following the proper protocols for dealing with the outbreak and stemming its spread.
This message comes from Here and Now's sponsor, Indeed. Are you hiring? With Indeed, you can post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on your short list of qualified candidates using an online dashboard. Get started today at Indeed.com/here now.
Let's bring in our political strategist to assess where we are in the 2020 presidential race. Joe Biden won big in Super Tuesday voting, and Mike Bloomberg has dropped out and is endorsing him. Bill Press is a Democrat, joins us now. Hi, Bill.
Hello, Jeremy.
And Alice Stewart, Republican. Hi, Alice.
Hi, Jeremy. Happy Super Wednesday.
I'm calling it Winnowing Wednesday because the field is winnowing.
Yes.
Joe Biden won in a lot of places that he didn't even advertise or campaign in or have any campaign infrastructure. He won Minnesota, which Sanders won 4 years ago. He won Texas. Nobody saw this coming a week ago. Here's Biden reacting last night.
Just a few days ago, the press and the pundits had declared the campaign dead. And then came South Carolina, and they had something to say about it.
Bill, what happened, and is this a fundamentally different race now?
Oh, absolutely fundamentally different. I got to tell you, I've been around politics a long time. I've never seen anything like this phenomenal turnaround in the Democratic primary. I don't think any of us have. As you pointed out, Jeremy, Joe Biden won 10 states out of 14. He went 33 years without winning one single state or primary, and in 4 days he's won 11 states.
Right.
You know, it's incredible. And he won where he didn't campaign, didn't spend any money, and didn't even have a campaign office. And I think what happened, I think it's a double thing. I think it was fear of Bernie on the part of a lot of Democrats, and I think it was fear of Trump on the part of a lot of Democrats who said, we got to get out there and vote, and we got to get out there and vote for the person that we think is the best chance of beating, has the best chance of beating Donald Trump. But I think one other key thing happened, very significant, the endorsements of Amy Klobuchar and Pete Buttigieg in particular. I think you can credit Amy Klobuchar with Minnesota, and you can credit maybe Beto with Texas, and Pete Buttigieg wherever else that Joe Biden did well. They made a big difference, and people were coalescing behind him, and now Bloomberg's out. So it gets down to, I think, what both of them want. Biden and Bernie Sanders want a real honest debate about which direction the Democratic Party ought to go in and which direction the country should go.
Well, and go ahead, Alice.
I will say I agree with Bill on all points. I'll add a few things. It's incredible, the turnaround. You had Joe Biden on life support just a few days ago. Now he's the comeback kid and makes Bill Clinton look like he's still in the dugout. It's amazing. But to further on some of Bill's points, I look at three coalitions that helped Biden do so tremendous yesterday, starting with the Jim Clyburn endorsement in South Carolina. That really helped him in South Carolina, which gave him momentum, and it also got the African-American vote on board. The Obama coalition, you cannot deny that that was helpful with the party establishment and helping to coalesce, as Bill said, Buttigieg, Klobuchar, and Beto, and really coalescing the party, and now Bloomberg as well. And also, there is the Sanders freakout coalition, when people realized that his socialist policies could potentially be at the top of the ticket, that got people off the couch and in the voting booth for Biden.
Let me push you on that, Bill, because you said that too, fear of Sanders. Is that fear on the part of Democrats of Sanders as president, or fear that Sanders wouldn't beat Trump?
I think it's the latter. I think it's they might agree with his policies and like to see them, but think that he might go too far too fast. And also give Trump a big, fat, easy target of running against a socialist. And I think Democrats, you know, if we look at turnout, most of the turnout was among late deciders. Even in California, the early vote was down because people were waiting to see what would happen in South Carolina. So I think that was the Democrats did or have done now, for the most part, what the Republicans failed to do in 2016. Those who were weaker recognized it, accepted reality. They got out and they endorsed the person they thought was the strongest one to lead the party. I have to say, if Republicans had done that in 2016, we would not have gotten Donald Trump.
Sanders did win California, though not by as much as expected. Here he is last night, already going on the attack against Biden.
One of us in this race led the opposition to the war in Iraq. You're looking at him. Another candidate voted for the war in Iraq.
Alice, what does Sanders do now? And when you hear those boos, does that make you happy?
Look, clearly that message is one that he can use. It's a valid argument for him to go after Biden for his vote on the Iraq war. But if you peel back the layers and you really take a look at it, that was a completely different time. We were of the mindset, the post-9/11, where we did believe there were weapons of mass destruction. We did believe there was connection to 9/11. And there were many Democrats in the Senate at the time that voted for that. Chuck Schumer, Hillary Clinton, amongst many others. But it is a valid attack. But Joe Biden has recognized that that was a bad vote. He has come around and realized that that's not what he should have done. But that clearly is an attack that Sanders will use against Biden, because the reality is that's really all he has, because the way that the party has coalesced behind Biden on a lot of the policy issues, he doesn't have much else room to go.
Well, Bill, what do you think happens now with Sanders? He's not going anywhere. This could be a long, drawn-out fight, and he does have a lot of support from people, you know, not just young people, but also a lot of people who feel that this economy is not working for them. It's not fair to them, and it needs to be totally overhauled.
Well, first of all, I think that's a very important point to make, is that the disaffected people, who a lot of whom voted for Donald Trump, who voted for Bernie Sanders in 2016 in the primary, are still there. And there are a lot of Americans who do feel that the establishment politicians of both parties have let them down, and we need something totally different. And the Republicans got that with Donald Trump, and a lot of Democrats are saying, it's now we got to go with somebody new. Look at Bernie Sanders. But I think, in direct response to your question, what happens now is bring it on. I think it's a good, clean debate that we're going to have from now to the convention between Joe Biden, with a more pragmatic, sensitive, saner approach, if you will, and Bernie Sanders, a bolder, more progressive approach. And Democratic Party will decide whether they're going to take a fling on, you know, a brand new bold politics or stick to a more establishment.
You know, there's
candidate.
Still Elizabeth Warren in the race, who came in third in her home state of Massachusetts last night. But here she was in Detroit. Listen to this.
I'm in this race because I believe I will make the best president of the United States.
Bill, there are some who think that the party wants her, the party, in quotes, wants her to stay in the race to be a Bernie spoiler.
I don't know that to be true, but I do know that I think the Joe Biden people want her to stay in, because if she's taking votes from anybody, she's taking votes from Bernie Sanders. And I know Elizabeth Warren believes that, but she came in third in her home state, and Joe Biden won Massachusetts without spending one dime or one day in Massachusetts. I think that says a lot.
I've never been a big fan of Elizabeth Warren and her plans, but I am now. I think she should continue to stay in this for the long haul, talk about her plans, flesh them out on the campaign trail until we get to Milwaukee. Stay in there. Go, Elizabeth.
Okay. Actually, speaking of Republicans getting involved in the Democratic race, Alice, are Republicans now going to go after Biden in Congress and do more investigations of Burisma and Hunter Biden, a la Hillary Clinton and Benghazi?
100%. Yes, that will continue. And it won't just be people on the Hill. This will be outside groups. There will be super PACs. There will be campaign operatives. There will be whisper campaigns. There will be outright campaigns, ad campaigns, specifically on issues of vulnerability for Joe Biden, and that is not unusual. The benefit of having a long history in politics is you have a long history of relationships and coalitions in politics. The downfall is you have a long history of records and questionable votes and relationships that you have built that might be questionable, and all of those are fair game, open for attack. And the same goes where on the Democratic side, the same kind of operatives will be once again dumpster diving in Donald Trump's trash and throwing what against the wall, whatever they think will stick.
Let me just say, Jeremy, I'm sure the Republicans will try to do whatever they can to embarrass or whatever to Joe Biden, but lots of luck. I think they'll be as successful as the Benghazi hearings were because they'll be so obviously purely political. And I'd add one other thing. These guys are up for re-election this year. And I think that's going to be their primary focus. And if they spend all their time on political attacks against Joe Biden, I think it could come back to bite them in the ass, and they'll stay away from it.
Well, and Alice, isn't a bigger problem right now for President Trump what's going on with coronavirus and not just questions about his administration's leadership and preparedness for this, but also what's happening to the economy? Conventions are being shut down left and right. Nobody's traveling like they used to. People are. I mean, are you worried about that for the election?
I don't see it as a problem as much as a serious concern. And I do think the administration has done a complete 180 and getting ahead of this now. It's really wise. They have a Mike Pence in charge of this, meeting with scientists and doctors today, meeting with airline industry officials, those in the nursing home industry, also with pharmaceutical companies. It is imperative to bring the scientists, the doctors, and these industry leaders and have a whole government approach to how to attack this. That's what the administration is doing. And I think the more they can communicate what is being done, the more they will help alleviate fears by not just Americans, but those that have an influence on the markets.
And Jeremy, every Donald Trump tweet this morning was about Mike Bloomberg, mini Mike, not about the coronavirus. He ought to stop that, do his job.
Bill Press, the Democrat, Alice Stewart, the Republican, thanks to both of you.
Thanks, Jeremy.
Okay, thanks, Jeremy.
Hi, this is Felix Contreras from NPR Music's Alt Latino podcast. As part of our Black History Month coverage, we take a look at the Afro-Latin roots of reggaeton and its rise over the last decade to become one of the most listened to musical genres on the planet. To check it out, download Alt Latino from wherever you get your podcasts.
The airline industry in China is beginning to show some signs of a rebound after being hit very hard by the coronavirus outbreak that has led to thousands and thousands of canceled flights. The outbreak is continuing to affect travel around the world. Let's bring in Here and Now transportation analyst Seth Kaplan. Hi, Seth.
Hi, Jeremy.
Okay, so what are these signs of a rebound in China?
Well, Chinese airlines have been adding back domestic flights. And not only that, but reports from very recent days, I mean, we're talking past 2 or 3 days, are that the flights are rather full. They have load factors, as airlines call them, of, you know, 75-80%, kind of the usual loads. Now, because not all the flights are back yet, that doesn't mean that 75 or 80% as many people are traveling as is usually the case. But that's a good sign of people starting to get back to life there, even though the coronavirus scare is very much present.
Well, and what about international flights? Because on a lot of airlines, they've canceled all their flights to China.
Right. And that's going to take longer. I mean, look, airlines around the world are going to be reluctant to restore flights for as long as governments around the world are warning people against non-essential or even all travel to China. And then even beyond that, things always look worse from farther away. So it's just going to take time for travel to rebound. If we think back to 9/11 in the U.S., very different situation, a tragic one, too. You know, Americans kind of began to go back about their business at a time when people around the world were still afraid to travel to the U.S. That's just kind of always how it goes. It's what's happening now with China.
I'm supposed to take a flight next week, and I just keep watching the seat map just open up and up and up, I guess, as people are canceling their flights, though. So maybe we're not there yet in the U.S.
Yeah, and so if we kind of use what's going on in China as a proxy, even though obviously every situation is different, that could be what happens. It seems like right now the bigger impact, there are some people not flying, but there are even more people not booking. People saying, I would fly today, but I don't know how things are going to look a month or two from now. And that's why you see airlines saying, well, if you book now, we'll let you be flexible, right? And so you could imagine the part of the travel demand softness that's just sort of fear. Right. Travel as a sector obviously is one of the most impacted by the coronavirus scare. But the part that's the fear, the part that's kind of like people clearing out the bottled water at the wholesale warehouses. Right. Even though I'm not sure what bottled water is going to do for us if we get coronavirus, those of us who have access to clean municipal water, that part of the scare is the kind of thing that if things just kind of stabilize, even if coronavirus is still around, maybe a month or two from now, people just kind of move on from it in the way that people in China are beginning to do. But we'll have to see.
Let me just ask you about one more thing. There's been a dispute between the CDC and airlines over collecting information from international passengers related to COVID-19. What's going on there?
Yeah, well, the CDC is asking airlines to share more information about passengers, to share contact details that they usually don't provide to the government, email addresses, that sort of thing. Airlines are saying, look, government, you've got that information in various databases anyway, and other countries around the world are managing without putting that responsibility on the shoulders of the airlines. So airline CEOs meeting with Vice President Pence, I mean, it's gotten to that level to try to iron this out.
Well, and in fact, the president stopped into that meeting today. So it's actually gone all the way up to the president of the United States and the CEOs of the airlines. Seth Kaplan, here now, transportation analyst. Thanks as always.
Thanks, Jeremy.
Nearly two dozen people are still missing in Tennessee after devastating tornadoes ravaged through Nashville early Tuesday. At least 24 people are dead, and that number could rise. Right now, crews are sifting through some of the areas most devastated. For the latest, we're joined now by Emily Seiner, a member station WPLN in Nashville. And Emily, what more can you tell us about the victims?
Yeah. So about 18 of the 24 people who've been reported dead were in Putnam County, which is about 90 minutes east of Nashville. The city there is called Cookeville. It has about 30,000 people and a university. And there's also an unincorporated community outside of it called Double Springs that was hit really hard. We know that a few children are among the dead. The oldest victims were a couple in their 80s who died in Wilson County, which is just outside Nashville.
And yes, you mentioned that was in most of them in Putnam County. What more can you tell us about the damage within the city of Nashville?
Yeah, in Nashville, we know that the tornado that came through here reached up to EF3 with speeds up to 150 or 160 miles per hour. There are dozens of building collapses, although we don't know yet how many homes have been lost or how many people have been displaced from the homes. We know that there are four schools in the city that are particularly damaged. A few of them are going to be closed for a while. And there's at least one school in Wilson County that's been completely demolished. In Putnam County, where a lot of the damage was, the National Weather Service couldn't even get there yesterday. So they're still determining that.
Yeah. Nashville Electric tweeted that four substations were damaged by these tornadoes, leaving thousands of folks without power. When can they expect to have their power restored?
We think that a lot of it will come back by Friday because they're going to be finishing up some of the substation work by the end of the week. But they say that if all goes well, most who receive power will have it back by Monday. So still several days. Right now, there are about 33,000 people without power still. And in the station, actually, we're running on a generator.
And where are people who are displaced going? What options do they have?
There are a few shelters around the city and in the surrounding counties. In Nashville, four of the shelters reported that they had 90 guests who stayed there overnight. Our housing agency has placed several dozen families in housing, and Airbnb is actually offering free housing for people who are displaced. But a lot of people, I think, if they have homes and have insurance, they're just going to hotels and trying to figure out what to do next.
Yeah. Have you had a chance to talk with some of the folks there and how are they coping with this? This is such a devastating event.
Yeah, it really, I mean, it is devastating. Like, if your home was hit, of course, that's unreal and completely shocking. But even if not, just to kind of see these buildings that you know, yeah, or these businesses that you love, like, yep, with their roofs blown off, it's just like this very emotional experience. And I think with tornadoes especially, it's this, it feels very surreal, because we've talked to residents who say their homes are completely fine, but then the block behind them is demolished and looks like an apocalypse movie set. Like, it just feels so arbitrary and surreal. So there's a lot of shock, but there's also this really strong desire to start helping. I was walking around East Nashville today and saw just neighbors kind of getting out there with work gloves and power tools and trash bags and trying to start cleaning.
Mm. That's Emily Siner of WPLN in Nashville with the latest on recovery efforts since the destructive tornadoes ripped through the area. Thanks so much for joining us, Emily.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Let's turn now to the rapidly shrinking Democratic presidential field. Former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg announced today that he is suspending his campaign. This comes after his debut on the ballot in the 14 states that held primaries on Super Tuesday. He only managed to win one contest in American Samoa. Immediately after announcing his exit from the race, Bloomberg endorsed former Vice President Joe Biden, who won big last night, dominating most of the contests, gaining more than 300 delegates. In a statement, Bloomberg said that he's, quote, always believed that defeating Donald Trump starts with uniting behind the candidate with the best shot to do it. And he says he believes Biden is that candidate. Biden trailed Bernie Sanders in the early primary states, prompting many to declare his bid for the White House moot. As last night's results trickled in, Biden made clear that that was not the case.
So I'm here to report we are very much alive. And make no mistake about it, this campaign will send Donald Trump packing.
For analysis on last night's results and what it means for the future of the race, I spoke earlier today with political commentator and former South Carolina State Representative Bakari Sellers, and I asked him about his thoughts on Biden's surprise win in Texas and the momentum that Biden has gained since last week's primary in South Carolina.
Well, I'm not really that surprised. I know some were. I was surprised by Massachusetts and Minnesota, but at the end of the day, what's carrying Joe Biden is what we always thought would, which are black voters. Black voters were 21% of the electorate, even in Texas, and he won that overwhelmingly. He won that with 60% of the vote. And so while many people after Iowa and New Hampshire wanted to crown Bernie Sanders the front runner, I was always cautioning people that you had to wait until black people voted. Black people have voted now, and now you see that the dynamics of the race have changed. Individuals have gotten out, and there's been a consolidation around Joe Biden.
Okay, I make the distinction when you say black voters, specifically of older Southern black voters. Do you make that distinction?
I do. I think that black voters 65 and above, Joe Biden has just overwhelmingly won. He actually did really well with younger black voters, too, winning those by not by such a large margin. But what you saw last night was Tennessee, Arkansas, Alabama, Virginia, North Carolina, and Texas all go for Joe. It'll be interesting to see what black voters do in a state like Michigan next Tuesday. But you can't be Democratic nominee without black voters. And that's what we're seeing now.
Let's talk a little bit about Senator Bernie Sanders. It appears he's taken California, Colorado, Utah, Vermont. You are not surprised by his performance this time around overall. I've heard you say a lot of the success of Bernie Sanders back in 2016 was just that he was not Hillary Clinton. Can you say more?
Yeah, I think what we're seeing, Bernie Sanders has done outreach. Don't get me wrong. And you're seeing the results of that outreach with Hispanic voters, particularly young Hispanic voters. He's doing extremely well with Hispanic voters under the age of 30. I mean, and that's the future. That's why we need Bernie Sanders to be a part of the process, unquestionably. But I do think that he's underperforming where he was in 2016, not just because there are multiple people in the race, but he is. And even through that underperforming, I think what we're starting to realize is that a lot of the success that Bernie Sanders had was due to the fact that he simply was not Hillary Clinton. And that is not the recipe. He's not actually expanding his base. He's not actually growing his base. And that's a fundamental problem.
Yeah, you bring up it's actually a good thing you believe that Bernie Sanders is part of this whole process. But can we talk for a moment about what appears to be two wings of the Democratic Party growing? I mean, the moderate wing in Joe Biden and this progressive wing in Bernie Sanders. I mean, this breaks down among age. What do you make of this? Do you think this is going to be a problem moving forward as we get closer to picking a Democratic nominee?
I think that the person who's on the sidelines, who is the most popular elected official, will come off the sidelines when that time is necessary, and that's Barack Obama. So I think we'll be okay.
Oh, you do see him coming off the sidelines. You think that he will?
At the appropriate time, he will. As a nominee is chosen, he will. And he'll make sure that everyone comes together behind whomever that nominee is. I think right now it's in all likelihood going to be Joe Biden. And so the band will be back together.
Yeah. There was this CNN poll from last night that shows that 58% of Democrats are voting with the belief that Biden can beat our current president, Donald Trump. Only 19% believe Sanders can actually beat Trump. Is the goal of beating President Trump in November still a good enough goal for Democrats? Or do you believe their priorities should lie elsewhere?
No, the number one goal is beating Donald Trump. There's no question now. That's not the ceiling. That's not as high as we go. That's the floor. We have to beat Donald Trump. We have to reclaim our country. And as Joe Biden says, this is a fight for the soul of our country. So, we believe in all of those things that make us a more perfect union. Donald Trump's the antithesis to that. And so whomever is in the best position to beat him, and I think a lot of us, including myself, believe that Joe Biden is best, especially for down-ballot races, whereas Bernie Sanders, even if he loses to Donald Trump, it won't be a singular loss. It'll be a devastating loss up and down the ballot.
That's political commentator Bakari Sellers. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Call me anytime.
There's growing concern about methamphetamine use in the drug overdose crisis. Recent numbers out of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention show deaths linked to these stimulants are rising fast, while deaths from opioids decline. But unlike opioids, there are no approved treatment medications for meth, and that has some patients taking desperate steps while they wait. Martha Biebinger from member station WBUR reports.
When meth users want to stop the cycles of sleepless days that ravage bodies, they often look for help. But Eric says he's had trouble finding programs that take patients addicted to meth.
So a lot of people have to lie to get in. You have to say alcohol.
Or take an opioid, something that will show up in a urine test. Once inside, Eric would talk his way into a 2 or 3 month program.
They don't really work on specifically meth addiction, so you just have to, the only thing that is good about it is it's an environment where I'm away from wherever I was using and around other people that hopefully want to get clean.
But after those few months were up, Eric would be back on the streets looking for housing and a job. We're only using his first name because Eric has used illegal drugs. At 32, he's tried most of them. These days, he's managing an addiction to heroin with buprenorphine. Fighting the powerful urge to shoot meth is more difficult.
So I was able to stop everything, literally marijuana, alcohol, everything except for meth.
Then Eric found Dr. Laura Keough. She's medical director of the Substance Use Disorder Bridge Clinic at Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston. She says more and more meth patients who can't get themselves away from meth approach her with what Keough calls a shocking request.
We're seeing people coming in desperation, asking to be essentially locked up, to be locked away from the substance, so to speak.
Keough won't do it.
And we know that that is not an effective strategy and is not a therapeutic intervention at all.
Instead, Keough says she books more frequent appointments with these patients at Mass General's walk-in clinic. She's building relationships, using meds to ease the patient's anxiety or depression, and connecting them to group counseling, social workers, and peer coaches.
We're all working together, trying to come up with creative and innovative ways as we wait for science to catch up.
Much of that catch-up is funded by the National Institute on Drug Abuse, where Dr. Nora Volkoff is the director. She agrees, finding ways to treat meth addiction must be a top priority as death rates rise.
It's very problematic. It's rising very, very rapidly, and we're far behind than from opioids.
Far behind in two ways. No approved medication to help patients stop using meth, and nothing like Narcan, the drug that reverses an opioid overdose. But there's a lot in the works. Let's start with preventing a meth overdose. Researchers are testing drugs they might inject in someone who's out of control on a meth high.
As Volkoff explains, the idea is that this injection would soak up meth in the bloodstream.
One of the most promising areas of research is the development of antibodies that can trap methamphetamine.
Stopping the meth before it triggers a heart attack, stroke, or life-threatening high body temperature. To treat an addiction to meth, some doctors try transitioning patients from meth to one of the prescription stimulants you may have heard of, Adderall, Vyvanse, or Ritalin, and then weaning patients off of those drugs.
There is some slight evidence of perhaps some level of therapeutic benefit from stimulant medications. But again, the effect sizes are very small and the evidence is weak.
Volkoff says studies are testing whether two meds used to treat opioid addiction might help with meth. There's some new research that shows one antidepressant reduced meth use. But in the absence of approved medicines to treat meth, Volkoff says the science points to a system of rewards for drug users, like food vouchers or movie passes, when their urine is drug-free.
That is the only strong evidence that there is benefit from a therapeutic intervention for methamphetamine. It does not mean that other interventions may not be useful. The evidence is not there.
Tell me about the meth now. How are you doing with that?
A lot better now.
Dr. Keough and Eric go over meds he's taking to treat problems that Eric has used meth for in the past.
What's been helping is the Wellbutrin and the gabapentin. Honestly, like low doses of that, and it gets me through the cravings and the depression that's associated with
it. Eric adjusts the doses daily as needed. He says gabapentin, a seizure med, curbs his cravings for meth. Right now, this ad hoc combination, along with counseling, works for Eric. He has a job, his own apartment, is back in touch with a cherished aunt, and hasn't used meth since September. For Here and Now, I'm Martha Biebinger.
Well, on the subject of healthcare, today saw the stock market jump significantly, not because everyone is more confident about the economic impact of the coronavirus, but perhaps because of Joe Biden's wins on Super Tuesday. Apparently, investors think it is now less likely there will be a total overhaul in healthcare, a la what Bernie Sanders has been talking about. CNBC reports United Health could see its best stock surge in more than a decade. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.